From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Every day, there is a new number. The U.S. logged more than 70,000 new coronavirus cases on Tuesday, according to the rolling seven-day average. That's higher than ever before. Places like Chicago are now reimposing restrictions on bars and restaurants as the city's positivity rate rises. Mercedes Carnathan is professor of preventative medicine and epidemiology at Northwestern University, and she joins us now. And Professor, the country just set a record for new infections according to the seven-day rolling average. How would you describe the state of the pandemic in the U.S. right now?
The state of the pandemic in the United States has really reached a critical point, and I think that's because we haven't had any break from all of this. We were hopeful that we could get things under control during the summer, and we had brief glimpses of improvement. But now we see this rebound that is even higher than it was in the springtime. So right now, you know, we're marching into a really challenging time that's scary for all of us.
Speaking of that rebound rate, the Chicago area where you are has seen its positivity and hospitalization rate rebound after coming down from their initial spike earlier in the year. We're also seeing places like Massachusetts trend back up. Why do you think the coronavirus pandemic is having such a widespread rebound in this country?
Part of the reason I think that the rebound has been so significant and so swift is because we have opened things back up again without actually controlling the background rate of disease down to the levels where we needed to. And now that the summer is over and people are tired of staying away from one another, and in the Midwest, you know, we've already had snow. So that means that activities that could have been safely outside during the spring and early fall now are coming indoors, where we're in closer proximity to one another and wanting to enjoy eating and drinking, which are activities that can't be done with a mask on.
Yeah, we're also doing more testing, which may explain some of the new cases. But we're also seeing these surges in hospitalizations, which would suggest this latest surge is not just asymptomatic cases. How concerned are you about hospital capacity across the country?
Hospital capacity to manage severe COVID is a significant concern, because that is an area that we need to keep a handle on so that we can continue to keep the death rate from COVID down lower. So one distinction I would make from the earlier peaks in the spring, when we had extremely high death rates, is that we didn't have the treatment strategies that we have now. However, we can only put those strategies into place if we have space for individuals within a hospital. And now that we've returned to elective surgeries and other ordinary hospital business, it's really going to put a pinch on all of our healthcare providers who are doing double and triple duty. And that could ultimately compromise the care of individuals with COVID, as well as our other leading causes of death of heart and lung disease.
Mercedes, do you think the reimposing of restrictions in places like Illinois will be enough?
I am hopeful that we choose restrictions that address behaviors and situations where we see the highest levels of transmission. And let me give you an example. So early on, we shut down everything. We shut down schools. We suggested individuals not go to workplaces. There were even fears about going to the grocery store and what could happen there. What we've learned is that there are certain scenarios where the illness is most likely to be transmitted, and we know this based on outbreaks that we've seen where we've got more than one case. The outdoor super spreader event at the Rose Garden is one example. Mm-hmm. You know, we see that even being outside but without a mask is a high-risk situation. If we can target those situations that are most likely to cause significant spread to a large group of people, we can effectively shut down. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make sense to shut down public spaces if, as people are estimating, the primary route of transmission right now are small group gatherings in people's homes. And I think we're going to see more of that as the holidays approach. And there's also this social challenge that we face, because if we say, you can't come into my house without a mask, it can feel as though we're placing a judgment on another individual who we think is going to give us COVID. But we have to be clear that these decisions about masking are not personal decisions, and they're not meant as judgments that someone's going to give us something.
That's Mercedes Carnathan, professor of preventative medicine and epidemiology at Northwestern University. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to Texas, where Republican Senator John Cornyn is facing an unexpectedly tough re-election fight. His opponent, the Democrat MJ Haggar, out-fundraised him in the latest quarter, and voters are turning out in droves in Texas. Brett Jaspers is a reporter for KERA in Dallas, and he joins us now for the latest in our Senate Tracker series. Brett, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And it was just 2 years ago when Beto O'Rourke tried to unseat the incumbent Republican Ted Cruz in Texas. He did better than people expected him to do. Of course, he still lost. But fast forward to 2020, and there's another close race. John Cornyn is fighting off his Democratic challenger. How does this year compare?
Well, it's interesting, right? Ted Cruz has such a strong national profile that I think there was quite a lot of national attention on his race. And of course, Beto O'Rourke became a Democratic star. And this year, I think there was expectation that it wouldn't be as interesting because John Cornyn doesn't have a super distinct brand apart from the Republican Party. And instead of a sleepy race, we've gotten quite a spirited contest between these two very distinct individuals, Cornyn, who's been in the Senate for 18 years, and MJ Haggar, who is this Democratic recruit who's a fresh face but has this military background, who she really tries to tie it to this idea of going to Washington and fighting for Texans just the way she did in the military. And she's quite pugnacious on the campaign trail. So it's this very surprisingly spirited contest.
Sure. And let's take a minute to kind of go through each one of these candidates here. Senator Cornyn recently spoke with the Chad Hastie Show on KFYO Radio in Lubbock, Texas, about President Trump.
I think he's taken the country in a strong direction. I look forward to serving with him for 4 more years. And I'm proud to say my voting record is supporting him and his agenda 95% of the time.
Brett, Senator Cornyn made those comments after an earlier interview with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram, where he compared his feelings about the president to, quote, women who get married and think they're going to change their spouse, and that doesn't usually work out very well. Tell us about Senator Cornyn's relationship with President Trump.
That's right. It raised some eyebrows here because it was an example of Cornyn trying to put some distance between himself and the president. He, of course, pushed back on that analysis in that clip that you played from the Chad Hastie Show. But Cornyn has been a very reliable Republican soldier. For example, one item that he said he expressed private concerns about was when President Trump used an emergency declaration in order to use military funds to build a border wall. Now, Cornyn says that he talked to Trump behind the scenes about that, and yet Cornyn still voted against a proposal to block that action by the president. So he seems to be trying to put some distance between himself and the president, but then he kind of also pushes back against that analysis. You know, I think what people could expect from another Cornyn term is another 6 years of very loyal Republican votes, no matter who's the president.
And plus, it sounds like you're saying he may be willing to go up against the president, but not publicly. Let's take a look at his opponent, MJ Haggar, a former Air Force pilot. She spoke at a campaign stop in Fort Worth earlier this month.
We are facing serious, significant domestic threats to our Constitution. We have an administration that is rallying violence and white supremacy and domestic terrorism. We have global enemies that think that they can run over our leaders, and we are withdrawing our influence at global institutions like the UN.
Tell us a little bit more about this candidate. You mentioned before that it seems like she's trying to thread a needle to be a Democrat in a really red state.
Yeah, she says she's going to go to Washington, fight for Texans, and work with whoever she happens to need to work with at the time. She has this military background where she not only withstood enemy fire while she served in Afghanistan, but also then quit the military in order to sue the Department of Defense over women being able to serve in combat officially and get that career advancement that comes with serving in combat. So she places herself as someone who fights the establishment and Hagar does bring a lot of the Texas to the race. She curses not infrequently. That's part of her persona, as like a fighting mom, is kind of how she posits herself as a politician.
And just quickly, I know Democrats are hopeful here that they can do something by flipping a red seat blue in the Senate. But what do the polls say? Because this is Texas, after all.
Right. There have been a lot of attention for quite even polls in the presidential race here in Texas, but Cornyn has been pretty consistently ahead in the Senate polls. So, you know, between 4 and 5 points, but also up to 10 points. So it seems that Cornyn has a lead that's been a lot more consistent than anything we've seen polling for the presidential race. So it's a different situation. People are seeing these races as distinct.
Brett Jasper is reporter for KERA in Dallas, Texas. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Less than a week to go in the election, and President Trump is holding two rallies in Arizona today. Joe Biden is in his home state of Delaware, where this afternoon he delivered remarks about the coronavirus.
And deaths and infections have hit record levels in the key state of Wisconsin yesterday, where Trump, at a rally, predicted a giant red wave of support building. An ABC Washington Post poll out today puts Biden 17 points ahead of the president in Wisconsin, but other polls have shown the race much closer. And to break down all of this, we have with us political strategist Matt Makowiak, who's a Republican. Welcome. And Jamal Hey. Simmons, who is a Democrat. Hi, Jamal.
Hey, good to join you guys. Hi, Matt.
Yeah, let's start with you.
Hey, Jamal.
Let's start with you, Matt. Yesterday, President Trump held his second campaign rally in Wisconsin, and he downplayed the coronavirus. Let's listen.
Normal life will fully resume. That's all we want is normal life. 7 months ago, right? We had the greatest economy in the history of our country. Everybody was doing well. Best numbers we've ever had. And next year will be the greatest economic year in the history of our country.
Matt, the president has been making his case in the upper Midwest, part of the blue wall that he toppled in 2016. How confident are you of a repeat in 2016? A repeat of 2016.
Yeah, look, there's tremendous debate about this right now. Is there a hidden Trump voter? Is Trump's ground game going to make up the deficit? Does the enthusiasm advantage that Trump has that we've seen in the polling, does that make a huge difference? Will Trump's expected overperformance with black voters and Hispanic voters, even if it's just a couple points, will that make a difference? Look, Biden's ahead. He's been ahead. I do believe Trump's closing. This election's going to come down to 5 or 6 states. And I think the most direct path for the president at this point is to hold North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, and Arizona and win Pennsylvania. And if he doesn't win Pennsylvania, he could win Michigan. I don't think Wisconsin will probably go in Trump's column. I think releasing a poll that says he's down 17 points is laughable. It's ridiculous. The president wouldn't have been there yesterday if he was in that kind of range. I talked to a very senior person in Wisconsin yesterday who told me that Trump was down 2. Now, even if that's a little rosy, if it's 5 points, releasing a poll like the Washington Post and ABC News did that showed him down 17, it is something that everyone involved with that ought to be fired, because there's simply no scientific or data-driven basis to a poll that says that he's down 17 points in a battleground state.
Well, Jamal, I want to get you in here. I mean, of course, there's always been questions about polling, but how does the blue wall look to you in 2020 and what you hear Matt saying here?
I don't think there's a blue wall higher than my waist anywhere in the country. we can all see over these blue walls. The Democrats are in a better position than they were in 2016. It's just obvious from the calendar. Vice President Biden is going into territory that was really Trump territory. There's really no state that Hillary Clinton won that Donald Trump looks like he has a chance at taking, but Biden is in Arizona. The Biden-Harris campaign are in Arizona and Texas and Georgia and, you know, they're North Carolina. They're on a lot of ground that was previously held by the president. So just if you look at the calendar, look at how the number of events they're doing and where they're spending money, what you see is the Biden campaign is on the offense. The Trump campaign is playing defense, and that's a good place to be.
Well, to that point, Joe Biden gave a speech in Warm Springs, Georgia yesterday. That's a state that hasn't voted for a Democrat for president since 1992. And Biden invoked President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who was treated for polio in Warm Springs.
The Bible tells us there's a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to heal. This is that time. God and history have called us to this moment and to this mission.
People are calling this Joe Biden's closing message. Jamal, what do you think? And then we'll go to Matt, because I want to know what both of you think. Which candidate is giving a stronger message here in the home stretch?
Well, you know, one thing that happens in campaigns is that the candidates start going after different populations of voters. And so it may seem like they're talking past each other, because they are. They're talking to different Americans. And one thing about this speech that strikes out to me is I think that Vice President Biden is trying to put the nail in on for seniors. The Democrats are now starting to lead with seniors for the first time in our recent memory. And if Joe Biden, using FDR as the backdrop, can get seniors to close down and the Trump campaign and focus on him, there's almost no way Donald Trump can be reelected.
Matt, what do you think when you hear Joe Biden's message there in Georgia, invoking the Bible, talking about a time to heal? What do you think about the closing message that he's making and how it compares to your candidate?
Yeah, I mean, I think from Biden's perspective, it's a smart message. I think in his core, he does want to unify the country. Whether the country's able to be unified after a divisive election, I think, is a totally separate question. But I think Biden, if left to his own devices, would probably try to work in a bipartisan way. Now, whether his administration and the left wing of the country and the Democratic Party would allow that, I don't know. I think that's a much bigger question. But look, I think Trump's closing message is that he's the right person to help rebuild the American economy. And given where we were before the virus came over from China and ravaged our country, I think he has a strong argument to make on that. Look, Trump's running on issues. He's running on the Supreme Court. He's running on safety in our cities. He's running on the economy. And he's running on Operation Warp Speed and getting the vaccine approved in the first or second quarter of next year and out to people. Biden's running on issues, too, but he's running a little bit more on other issues, like on other aspects of this, you know, the divisiveness, unifying the country. Voters vote on issues, generally. I mean, the issues decide races and positioning, and all those things matter. They're both going to make their closing argument. We'll see how it affects things. I do, again, think Trump has been closing in the last 10 days. The very successful second debate, I thought he did really well. He's doing 5 rallies a day now, getting tens of thousands of people to show up, all the data they're collecting, all the enthusiasm. I think it matters. I think Trump has momentum right now, and he's closing fast.
Well, Matt, I mean, that's really interesting that you say that the president is running on issues, because clearly that's not what we've been seeing over the last few weeks. And at the last debate, especially, we did not see the president actually talking about issues and the way that he will unify the country, the way that he will stop the coronavirus. But I want to ask you specifically about Texas. I mean, we're seeing record voting in Texas. A Real Clear Politics polling average gives Trump a 2.6% edge there. But yesterday we learned that up to 1,000 National Guard members could be deployed to cities across the state ahead of Election Day on Tuesday, because there's just fear of violence. Why do you think Texas is so close when it has been traditionally a Republican health state?
Well, I think the public polling is not good. It's not done well. It's done cheaply. The way that it's weighted to census data, I think, makes it inaccurate. And I think they oversample Democrats. And that's all those points have been true as it relates to Texas polling. Look, if Texas were truly a battleground state, Biden would be treating it like it's a battleground state. He hasn't been here. They haven't invested here. They're doing, you know, a half day of stops on Friday with Kamala Harris. Really is just something to kind of get Beto O'Rourke and a couple Texas Democrats to stop complaining. It's not a real effort to flip a state.
Oh, that's Texas interesting. Jamal, I want to bring you in. What is your thoughts about Texas when you see that these really close margins and this record turnout for folks voting?
Texas is elusive, and I'd love to say I think that it was higher on the list, but you know, I have to live by the sword that I started wielding in the beginning of our conversation, which is look at the calendar. And I think the Biden campaign is focused on Texas. It also helps the Senate race. I think they've got more vote-rich targets in places like Georgia. And lastly, I'll just say this. You know, I've been going back and looking at a little history. In 1968, Trump likes to kind of position himself as Nixon in that campaign, Law and Order. It may actually be that Trump is LBJ. And when Americans fell out of favor with LBJ's judgment that he could fix Vietnam, there was really nothing else that he could do. It ended up, you know, obviously not even running for re-election. I think people have lost trust in Donald Trump's judgment that he can fix COVID. And there's no way he can get out of that box.
Jamal, you say look at the calendar. So let's do that, because a week from today, we may come to work and not know whether or not there's a new president or a different president. We don't know. We might not know who won. So what would you advise your party to do if we still don't know who the winner is a week from now?
So I was Al Gore's spokesman in West Palm Beach during the recount back in 2000, so I feel this very deeply in my bones. Yeah. The one thing the party cannot do is to leave it up to the lawyers. There's going to be a legal process. You're going to have cases to manage. But the thing that the Bush, W. Bush forces did very well is they fought on political ground and made the case that this was George Bush's presidency that Gore was trying to take away from him. The Democrats this year have got to fight in every way possible, in politics, in media, putting voters on the streets, as well as in the courtroom. This cannot be left up to Donald Trump, who is a media manipulator, par none.
What's your message, Matt?
Yeah, I'm actually pretty concerned about the next, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for the country. I think we may see 1968-style protests and riots around the country. I think there's a scenario where Trump may have won on election night, but then either legitimately or perhaps illegitimately loses it over the next 2 to 3 weeks as mail ballots come in, as courts rule. All the states have different laws. And I think there's a
real
risk.
Do you trust him not to add fire to that fuel, though, Matt?
Well, what I would say is I think there's a real risk that half the country is going to view the result as illegitimate, whether it's legitimate or not. And I really am concerned about that. I believe he will accept the results of the election once the legal process is complete. And I think that Biden will do the same. But I think we're going to be in for some uncertainty for a few weeks. I don't know that this is going to be settled unless it's a landslide one direction or the other.
We'll find out soon. Here and now, political strategists, Republican Matt Mikowiak, Democrat Jamal Simmons. Thanks to you both. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Take care.
With an alarming rise in the number of young people getting colon cancer, a group of medical experts is recommending that screenings start at the age of 45 instead of 50. Each year, nearly 137,000 people in the U.S. are diagnosed with the disease. More than 53,000 are likely to die from it this year. Nicholas St. Fleur is a reporter with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. He joins us now on Skype. Nick, the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force was particularly concerned about the rise in colon cancer in young black men. Tell me more about the recommendation to start screening at 45.
Most of the reasons why they are suggesting pushing the age down to 45 has to do with the research that they've looked at. And what they have found is that in 2016, they were noticing in people who were 45 a similar incidence of colorectal cancer as they saw in people who were 50 in the year 1992. So if you have people, you know, in 2016 who are 45, so younger than people who were 50 in 1992, and they're showing the same incidence, that shows that colorectal cancer is appearing more often in people who are younger. And although these are new recommendations from the U.S. Preventative Services Task Force, another organization, the U.S. Multi-Society Task Force on Colorectal Screening, had a recommendation since 2017 that black adults should get screened for colorectal cancer beginning at the age of 45.
Do doctors know why younger people are getting sick with this disease?
They do not know yet the reason why. There have been studies maybe looking to tie it into, you know, diets, but there is a lot of research investigating it, especially in racial and ethnic minority groups.
So this recommendation from this task force could affect how insurance companies handle these claims. Some already allow for screening to begin at the age of 45, but what about for those who are younger than 45? Because in theory, they still wouldn't know if they have colon cancer until it's too late.
If there's one thing that the gastroenterologists that I'm speaking to are really hammering home is that this is not just an old person's disease. This is something that is affecting younger people. According to the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, from my understanding, the ACA will cover anyone who is looking to get screening who is over the age of 50. This would lower that age to 45. Now, one thing I want to mention is that there are different types of screening. The most famous are colonoscopies. The others are stool tests. And what I'm hearing from talking to gastroenterologists is that stool tests should be encouraged more. Those are easier to do, and you can send those to people. They send you back their stool, and it tests for whether it be blood in the sample or it tests for cancer DNA in the sample. Physicians I've spoken to, they're really trying to push those, especially amongst younger people. But I do not know when it comes to health insurance coverage, how that works right now. And the big take-home message here is the best screening is the screening that you do.
That's Nicholas St. Fleur with our partners at STAT, the Health and Medicine publication. Nick, thanks for your time. Do appreciate it.
You take care.
Vice presidential nominee Kamala Harris is in Arizona today, and so is President Trump, who now has less than a week to reverse poll numbers that show Republicans are at risk of losing Arizona for the first time in 24 years. His supporters still have plenty of faith. I met Bruce Pastel and Linda Durkee at a recent rally outside Phoenix.
We're hopeful.
Well, we're Trump supporters.
Yeah.
And we were here in 2016, and the polls looked pretty dim for him then. I have a feeling that we can count on that happening again.
Yeah, big believers, and I think they're going to come through, and we're going to get Arizona through as well.
But if the polls are right, there will be a few reasons Arizona turns blue in 2020. The state's demographics are changing fast. Liberal voters are moving from more expensive states like California, and young immigrants are voting for the first time. Alejandra Gomez deserves some credit for that. She's the co-director of a group called Lucha, which came together a decade ago when Republican state lawmakers passed the anti-immigration law known as SB 1070. That law got attention around the world, and it angered people in Arizona who'd never participated in politics before. When I met Gomez in her Phoenix backyard earlier this week, she told me that if Joe Biden wins Arizona in 2020, it'll be a result of the work that emerged in that fight back in 2010.
I remember also doing a 7-day fast with other volunteers. And when we heard that SB 1070 was going to be signed into law, I found myself at the Arizona State Capitol in a prayer vigil with seven other community volunteers. And that group of seven turned into hundreds of thousands of people doing not only marches and protests, but also the voter registration work, which at that time, the work was to expand the electorate.
So if that moment was as important as you say it is, why haven't Democrats won in Arizona at the presidential level?
For our communities, this has been a long time of planting seeds, inviting communities that have been victims of voter suppression, not invited to ever cast a ballot. All of those years of exclusion and harm, it's taken community organizations like ours to build trust with communities. Arizona had long been fighting for resources to take on people like Arpaio, to take on people like Russell Pierce. And time and again,
Pierce was the architect of SB 1070.
Pierce was the architect
of SB 1070. Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, both of whom are no longer in office.
Correct. Those were deemed fights that we would not win because, quote unquote, the Latino community does not vote. And what we demonstrated through those fights is we were able to take Sheriff Arpaio out of office through the ballot. And that's because we went to those communities where the BIPOC Black Indigenous communities had been excluded and invited them to, one, register to vote and then to get out the vote. And our communities did. And so what we're seeing now, 10 years later, is all of that work, but then the investment of being now a battleground state. We're seeing our communities take the conversations that are happening at the kitchen table about politics and actually translate those into votes at the polls.
So now your prize is even bigger than Sheriff Joe Arpaio. You're trying to win for Joe Biden. He's been criticized for taking the Latino vote for granted, for only making one visit to Arizona, for instance, the surprise battleground state. Do you think he's doing enough so far to get people motivated to vote for him here?
What we have seen from the presidential campaign is that they are doing more than any other presidential candidate has done for the Latinx community, for Black, Indigenous people of color. But the thing to understand also is that our communities are not a monolith, and we are very diverse. So the lesson that we should learn even out of this cycle is that we actually need, moving forward in a post 2020 world, we need to see nuanced cultural messaging early on in May versus starting in August.
But I want to make sure I understand what you're saying here. Are you satisfied with the level of investment the National Democrats have put into Arizona, especially when you see what Donald Trump is doing? He's been to this state over and over again. Mike Pence has been to this state. They're coming again this week. They believe that they can take Latinos who are conservative and get them to support their candidacy. And doing so, even just at the margins, 1% to 2%, would be enough to keep Arizona red. So who's doing more and who's doing better?
The community that always has done the most for Black, Indigenous people of color, and that's the community organizations on the ground. Lucha is part of not only leading Lucha Blue campaign, which for us means that we're turning Arizona blue this year, and we're part of the MIAZ coalition, where we're set out to turn out 1 million voters to the polls of Black, Indigenous communities of color and new American majority. And for us, that is really important because we're the communities that have been out there registering voters, organizing off-cycle. We're not waiting the way that we never waited during the Arpaio fights, during the Russell Pierce fights. We have delivered for our communities what our communities deserve.
As you say, the Latino vote is not a monolith. It's clear. I've met many conservative Latinos who are motivated by the president's message on abortion, for instance, who say Latinos don't want handouts. They want to pull themselves up just like everybody else to pursue the American dream. What do you say to those conservative Latinos who might be considering Donald Trump and who might, as I said, keep the state red?
You know, our primary fight sent a very clear and resounding message. Traditionally, District 27 would vote for a pro-life candidate. This year, they voted in the primary to move forward with Diego Rodriguez, who is a pro-choice candidate.
And this is a state legislative district.
Correct. It's a state legislative district. And that district sent a message that we are voting for people that truly are fighting for justice, equity, women's rights, women's health. And we are not stopping until we see legislative majorities locally, but also nationally, with candidates that represent the interests of our communities. Our community is paying attention that the Trump administration is the single biggest threat to our communities.
How confident are you that at the end of Election Day, Wednesday, November 4th, we're going to know who won Arizona?
We already have seen historic numbers of people that are registered to vote for this election. In Maricopa County alone, Adrian Fontes said that we had
the county recorder,
2.6 million people that registered to vote. Democrats are, we have about 100,000 lead right now in our early vote returns. That all means that it may take a little longer, but that means that the county recorder is doing their due diligence in counting every single vote, making sure that every single Arizonan's vote is cast and taken and accounted for. So it will take us a little longer to know. But I trust.
Does that worry you? I mean, because if it takes, the longer it takes, the more politicized the process can become.
You know, I think Arizonans are paying attention and we want a fair count.
Election night, there's a lot on the line for everybody involved. There's also a level of excitement and nervousness. Just level with me. How nervous are you going into election night?
You know, I went canvassing on Sunday, and we knocked on the door of a gentleman. He just became a citizen August 31st, and he was so excited to cast his ballot for the future President Biden. And it grounded me in the fact that our communities, one, are paying attention, and they want to be able to participate. So all I can say is that I've heard this before. Panic is not a plan. We need to be out there knocking on doors, reminding our families, our cousins, our neighbors, our tías, our tíos, to get out and make sure they are casting their ballot.
Alejandra Gomez, thank you for letting me come into your backyard and sit down and have a conversation with you about politics. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was great.
How much power should sites like Twitter and Facebook have in determining what content users see or don't see? And how much responsibility do they bear for how their users behave or are on their platforms? Those were two questions at the heart of today's Senate Commerce Committee hearing about Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. Section 230 allows websites to moderate content they find violent, harassing, or otherwise objectionable. But it also says those websites cannot be held liable as publishers. In other words, you can't sue Facebook for false information the same way you may be able to sue a newspaper. While both President Trump and presidential candidate Joe Biden have both said 230 should be revoked, although for different reasons, some Democratic senators today are calling this hearing a sham. And for the latest, let's bring in Sarah Morrison, who's been watching today's hearings for Recode. And Sarah, let's start with the conservative case against Section 230. Here's Republican Senator Cory Gardner of Colorado questioning Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey and making the case that big tech is guilty of anti-conservative bias. Let's listen.
Mr. Dorsey, do you believe the Holocaust really happened, yes or no?
Yes.
So you would agree that someone who says the Holocaust may not have happened is spreading misinformation, yes or no?
Yes.
I appreciate your answers on this, but they surprise me and probably a lot of other Coloradans and Americans. After all, Iran's Ayatollah has done exactly this. So it's strange to me that you've flagged the tweets from the president, but haven't hidden the Ayatollah's tweets on Holocaust denial or calls to wipe Israel off the map.
Sarah, how did Dorsey defend Twitter's policies here?
Jack Dorsey said that basically not all misinformation is flagged or deleted by Twitter. I think anybody who's used Twitter can probably agree with that. It's really only mis or disinformation that is manipulated media, concerns public health, or concerns, you know, elections and voting that violate that policy. And the tweets from the Ayatollah of Iran didn't do that.
As we mentioned, it's not just conservatives who take issue with Section 230. Joe Biden told the New York Times editorial board last year that Section 230 should be revoked because Facebook is, quote, propagating falsehoods they know to be false, and it's totally irresponsible. Yet Democrats did not seem as keen to take up Section 230 today, with Senator Brian Schatz of Hawaii calling the hearing a hit job and a sham. What reason did he give?
Well, several Democratic senators, including Schatz, have said that, you know, the hearing and the timing of it is really more about bullying platforms into letting Trump and others tweet misinformation freely without, you know, getting fact checks or whatever on them. And so that's just really a way for Republicans to amplify like an anti-Biden or pro-Trump content that they believe social media platforms have unfairly censored. And then this is coming days before an election that where that kind of content could influence an outcome.
You know, the pitfalls of Section 230 made news just a few years ago, folks might remember, because it was used to defend Backpage.com. That was a website featuring ads for child sex trafficking. But as many have pointed out, without Section 230, websites could also be liable for every lie or illegal activity someone posts on those sites. I mean, you can imagine the avalanche of lawsuits there. So, Sarah, if Section 230 does get revoked, what would this mean for the internet as we know it? Would websites like Facebook and Twitter even exist?
Well, Senator Moran sort of alluded to this. He said, you know, the moderation that these platforms do is very expensive. I think the CEO said they spend actually billions on this. How could a small company ever be able to do this? And so I've seen that point made by him and others that, you know, if Section 230 were just revoked outright, then a company like Facebook or Google may have the money to survive this. But would anybody else, right? Like, how could a small company be able to to do the moderation at the scale that they would need to? And Mark Zuckerberg actually made the point that Facebook wouldn't have been able to exist in the first place without the Section 230 protection. So, I mean, in terms of the internet as we know it today, what would happen? I think we wouldn't just see the sites just disappear. I think we would see them just not moderate anything at all. Which is, you know, an internet that I think most people really don't want anymore.
Based on what you heard today, do you think Section 230 is an area where we will see any bipartisan reform?
I do, because we heard politicians from both sides, you know, the ones who weren't like using this to grandstand. We see them sort of say that they think maybe having more transparency or clarity around moderation decisions or rules or recourse for people to appeal them, that might be something that would help. There have been a couple bipartisan bills about Section 230. Actually, one that became law, which regards this Backpage case you referred to. So it's not unrealistic to think we can see something in the future. I think what that looks like would depend on the results of the election. We could also see reforms come not through Section 230 legislation, but like antitrust that might make it so there's competition, you know, like more of these platforms can exist, and then you get, you know, people can choose which ones they want, which moderate the way they want them to.
Sarah Morrison covers tech for Recode. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Yeah, sure. Thanks.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. Polls show the presidential race in Pennsylvania is tight. We'll hear from black voters in Philadelphia about what's driving them to the ballot box next time on Here and Now.